This summer, the Massachusetts legislature passed a law on equal pay that forces employers to make certain changes to their business practices. It's an effort to attack the persistent pay gap between men and women by restricting what businesses can and cannot do. But Boston has spent the past year on a very different approach that focuses on what employees can do for themselves. WBUR's Ininjor Enwemeka this morning takes us inside a free workshop for women on how to negotiate for higher pay.
16 women gather at the public library in West Roxbury. The group includes a lawyer, a social worker, a high school counselor, and a recent college graduate. They all share a common concern: how to make sure they're earning the pay they feel they deserve.
Well, let me just ask one thing. How many of you love to negotiate?
Julia Geisman leads the group discussion. She runs a company focused on advancing women in the workplace.
So one loves, two says, well, okay, I'll kind of live with it. How many of you would rather put a nail in your eye than to negotiate? Raise your hand. Oh, isn't that interesting? So, obviously, this is an area that is one of those areas that's an opportunity for growth.
For most in the group, the thought of asking for a raise or promotion causes a lot of anxiety. They don't want to seem entitled or greedy. For Jimena Sanchez Samper, a psychiatrist, there's also a little fear.
I think for both of us, it's sort of like the fear that it might bring out my angry side. Mm-hmm. So it's I'm Colombian, so that doesn't look so good. But I think, you know, because it does bother me, because so I'm afraid that anger is going to come out.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. Do you self-promote? Do you let people know your accomplishments?
I think I'm starting to, but it's taken me 20 years.
Okay, this is part of the problem. This is part of the problem. We don't let people know.
And that's what these women are here to learn: how to advocate for themselves in the workplace and become more comfortable negotiating. It's all part of an initiative by the City of Boston to offer free salary negotiation workshops for women. The idea is to empower women to ask for more money and help close the gender wage gap one workshop at a time. Part of the session involves practicing how to ask for more money. So the women pair off and do a role play. Jimena Sanchez Samper turns to her friend Jemima Arthur.
You know, is there a range that you had in mind? What do you start off with most people or employees in my position? Well, I think for somebody with your level of expertise, you would probably start off at around $49,000 a year.
$49,000. Okay, well, I think I'm more than qualified. I think I have, as you see, some of the requirements and the responsibilities that you're asking for. I am a graduate. I've been doing this for almost 10 years now, so I think maybe 55, 60 would be ideal for me.
In Boston, women earn 83 cents for every dollar men make. Nationally, women make 79 cents for every dollar men make. For women of color, the pay gap is much wider. From the City of Boston's perspective, this isn't just about helping individual women. It's about the city's economy. Megan Costello oversees the workshop initiative as the head of the city's Office of Women's Advancement.
So if the majority of our city is underpaid and not paid what they're worth, that not only hurts them as individuals, but that it hurts their families, their communities, and it hurts the entire city of Boston. It hurts our entire economy. And so this is the right thing to do, but is also important to the economic vitality of the city.
But can a workshop really help close the gender wage gap? Some economists, like Claudia Golden of Harvard University, don't think so. At least, not by much.
It can move the needle, but it's not going to move the needle much. I view this as low-hanging fruit, and I often say, pick the low-hanging fruit and eat it, but it's not going to be a full meal.
Golden says since women are disproportionately the caregivers, changing policies around child care, elder care, and even extending the school day would have a much greater impact on closing the wage gap.
There was a time when we said women aren't educated as well. They don't major in subjects that are as relevant to the job market as men. They don't go to professional schools. Now they do all of that. So we've fixed a lot of things, but there are aspects of the labor market with regard to men and women that are far more difficult to fix, and those often involve what goes on in people's personal lives and in their homes.
The city is hoping to create a cultural shift. Megan Costello says the negotiation workshops are just a piece of a very large puzzle. Earlier this month, equal pay legislation was signed into law in Massachusetts. The city of Boston is also working with employers to collect wage data and assess company policies and practices. It's clear there's still work to be done. But what's unclear is what impact the salary negotiation workshops will actually have. That's something the city plans to assess through surveys. For now, back in West Roxbury, the session left many of the women feeling a bit more confident. Jimena Sanchez-Samper says she now feels better talking about money.
You know, money is always one of those difficult things to talk about, you know, sort of like politics. So being able to develop a comfort level and being able to talk about money was the biggest thing that I wanted to learn. And I'm just even more confident. We'll see what happens.
Many here hope what happens next is at least a shift in their own paychecks. For 90.9 WBUR and Bostonomics, I'm Zininjor and Wameka.
And now the presidential campaign. Donald Trump stuck to the script at a rally in Manchester, New Hampshire yesterday, where one-time Trump rival Dr. Ben Carson introduced him to a cheering crowd. Reporter Emily Corwin from the New England News Collaborative was there.
The Radisson Ballroom is not yet full. Trump won't arrive for almost an hour, and the crowd is chanting, "Lock her up." Peter Vincello from Raymond is here with his 15-year-old son.
And he kind of talked me into it. I was actually supporting Cruz in the primary.
Now Vincello says he feels good about supporting Trump.
He says all the right things. He hits all the right Second Amendment, getting the economy back. Law and order.
Trump won the primary in February here by a wide margin, as did Bernie Sanders. But today in New Hampshire, Trump is trailing Hillary Clinton in the polls. And Thursday afternoon, he brought a singular focus to his rally before a crowd of a couple hundred. He directed blow after blow to one person only, his Democratic rival, Hillary Clinton.
It's hard to tell where the Clinton Foundation ends and where the State Department begins. Access and favors were sold for cash. It's called pay for play.
Trump went after Clinton's pricey speeches and the private email server. But when the crowd started chanting, "Lock her up" again, Trump tried something new.
Let's just win on November the 8th.
Hillary Clinton delivered a speech in Nevada Thursday accusing Trump of taking hate groups mainstream. But in his speech, Trump argued to a largely Caucasian crowd that he, not Clinton, is the candidate who will do the most for communities of color.
This is the year that the people who have been betrayed by Democratic policies, including millions and millions of African American and Hispanic American citizens, reject the politicians who have failed them over and over and over again.
That message seemed to resonate with one fan bedecked in Trump paraphernalia, Erica DeBenedictis.
I think it's all about inclusion. I love his message. I think that he's not a divider. I think he's unfairly portrayed, and I feel very positive about him staying on message.
A year ago in the primary, Trump characterized most Mexican immigrants as drug dealers and rapists. 74 days from the general election, Donald Trump is recasting that message on immigration.
If you want to have strong borders so that people come into our country but they come in legally through a legal process. That doesn't make you a racist. It makes you smart.
But Trump says he still promises to build a wall 100%. Next up for Trump, a campaign stop in Vegas. I'm Emily Corwin.
The group the U.S. Drought Monitor says 17% of Massachusetts is now under extreme drought conditions, with another 55% in severe drought. More than half the cities and towns in the state have imposed water restrictions. So what kind of long-term impact could this have, and what's ahead? WBUR meteorologist David Epstein joins us now by Skype to talk about it. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Bob.
So first of all, the statistics, just how dry has it been this summer in the state?
So right now, as of this morning, Boston's had 3.92 inches of rain in meteorological summer since June, and that puts us at number one. If we got a little shower this afternoon and got 0.06 of an inch, we'd go to number two. But the bottom line is it's been an incredibly dry summer, especially in greater Boston.
And it's not just the summer. It's also one of the driest years on record so far, as I understand it.
That's right. It depends where you are. So if we go down to Hartford, it's number six since January. Boston's 12. Worcester's 17. Providence is 42, not quite as dry. But what I've really been focusing on is since April. So since April, we've had less than 50% of the average precipitation, and we're ranked about number two or three in terms of the dryness. And that's the growing season, and that's putting a lot of stress on plants.
Is there one weather pattern to blame for this drought, or has it been a series?
Well, it's basically persistent, what we call high pressure. So high pressure, the air sinks, it dries out, it gets warm, and the highs have just been coming in. Really, since the middle of April, we get a new high after new high after new high, and it just doesn't allow precipitation to develop. The high's been anchored off the coast, and that's one of the reasons why we've seen that rain as it moves from the Berkshires towards the coastline. It just kind of dries up.
All right, you talked a moment ago about some of the impact. Let's talk a little more about that on our lawns, on our flowers.
So, of course, lawns and perennials and annuals, a lot of those are under stress. Some have died. The lawns will eventually come back. But it's really the woody things, the trees, the shrubs, the rhododendrons. If you look at rhododendrons, they're curled up as if it were below 32 degrees. And that's really putting a lot of stress on the plants. It's a great idea. Forget the perennials and annuals. Really water some of those woody plants. Water deeply, water for a long period of time. See if you can get them revived, because if they don't revive with water, guess what? They're not going to survive.
We're headed into the fall, of course. So what about the fall foliage this season? Is it impacted by the drought? And what about apple picking this fall?
Right. So more negative stuff in the areas which have extreme drought. The foliage season is really going to be pretty poor. The good news is northern New England has seen much more in the way of rain, so I think it's going to be a very nice foliage season for Vermont, New Hampshire, Maine, and parts of the Berkshires. But in the greater Boston area, leaves are already curling up, falling off, and that's because the trees are under stress. If you had a tree that was already under stress and then you put a drought on top of it, some of the trees could see some significant dieback. In terms of apple picking, the apples will be smaller. Those farms which don't have irrigation are really going to have problems, but farms locally that have irrigation, the apples will still be smaller, but they'll still be a great crop, and it's still a great chance to support local farming.
How much rain would we need over a period of time to get out of this, to bring us back to normal?
Well, I'd love to see a couple of weeks or 3 weeks of rain where we start getting 4, 5, 6 inches of rain, several months where you ended up 2 or 3 inches above the average each month. That would start to get us out of the deficit. Unfortunately, that is not in the cards. September right now looking very dry. It's also looking very warm. And that means that the drought's going to continue. One positive, or a couple of positives, if you're wondering, there are positive things. Tomato season is unbelievable. Without the rain, there's no diseases, so the tomatoes are fantastic. And the tick population is actually lower, Bob, because the ticks have either gone dormant or died. They're still out there, but they've really been suppressed.
All right, WBUR meteorologist David Epstein, thanks a lot for speaking about the drought with us this morning and what's ahead. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
With just over 9 weeks to go to Election Day, the presidential campaign has taken another nasty turn. This week, Hillary Clinton called Donald Trump someone who took over the Republican Party for the far right and suggested racism is at play. Trump called Clinton a bigot and also attacked the Clinton Foundation. Joining us this morning to talk about all this is our political team, Democratic analyst Dan Payne and Republican analyst Todd Domke. Good morning, Dan.
Morning, Bob.
And good morning, Todd Domke.
Good morning.
So with the campaign clock ticking down, Donald Trump is trying several new gambits. First of all, after flailing around for most of the summer and watching his poll numbers plummet, he's now largely sticking to the script, hammering away at hidden State Department emails and the questions over whether the Clinton Foundation was used as sort of a bank for deposits for people trying to buy State Department access. A new poll shows just 11% of people think Hillary Clinton is trustworthy. Is this line of attack hurting Dan Payne?
Well, it's not so much that Trump's new attacks are hurting, because it's only in recent days that he's turned his fire at Hillary Clinton rather than other Republicans or a Gold Star family. What's hurting Clinton is a sloppy AP, Associated Press story, that declared that more than half of those who met with Clinton as Secretary of State gave money to her foundation. But AP, for some reason, only looked at 154 meetings that she'd had, not 1,700 meetings that she actually held with world leaders. So when you look at the correct number, the 1,700 meetings, then only 5% of those that she met with contributed to the foundation.
Todd Domke.
Well, Clinton does continue to suffer from most voters thinking she is not honest and trustworthy. And questions about the Clinton Foundation and her emails are serious issues. You know, conflict of interest, special access for foreign donors. But every time she's on the defensive, Trump says something foolish, and the focus goes back to him. So this time, 70 days from the election, Trump makes a complete mess of his central issue, immigration. He said he's softening his policy on deportation of 11 million, sounding like Jeb Bush. Then he says maybe he is hardening his position. So with all his flip-flopping, nobody can explain what he supposedly believes. So now the Clinton controversy seems like a rehash of old news, and it's Trump who's on the defensive.
Well, this is all part of Trump's gambit to try and win some support from black and Latino voters. He's openly courting them now. What's in play here? What's at stake for him, Dan?
Well, Trump has said some embarrassing things just about every time he speaks about race. And recent polls show that Hillary Clinton is getting 91% of the black vote and 81% of Hispanic voters. Well, what worries the Donald's team is that many white voters don't like to support a racist. Now, Trump only a few days ago met with Hispanic leaders, and as Todd said, he softened his tone, his anti-immigrant tone. But right-wing radio impresario Rush Limbaugh found it laughable that Trump now sounds like Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio when it comes to immigration.
Todd, do you think Trump is going to succeed in attracting more black and Latino support? What's he going to do?
Well, according to Trump's new handler, Kellyanne Conway, a Republican pollster, Trump is appealing to minorities largely to convince white, college-educated suburbanites, women, and millennials that he is not the bigoted, scary demagogue they think. That's why Trump made his supposed pitch to black voters to a largely white audience, and he still hasn't addressed a black audience directly. The blatant way he talked about black Americans to the whites supporting him was insulting, saying that all blacks lived in poverty in inner cities that were like war zones. Those were his words. He can't win with 2% of the black vote or 20% of the Hispanic vote or losing white suburban voters.
Hillary Clinton is ratcheting up criticism of Trump, saying he's taking a hate movement mainstream and is peddling bigotry. Trump then hurls the bigot label right back at her. Is Clinton's language somehow converting new voters to Hillary Clinton? What's her strategy along these lines, Dan Payne?
Her strategy strategy is to let him talk and talk and talk and say stupider and stupider things. A bigot is defined as a person who can't tolerate others who have different opinions or backgrounds. I guess he's dropped crooked Hillary in favor now of bigoted Hillary. There's a priceless piece of footage that's been playing on TV of a woman at a Trump rally who hears Trump say Clinton is a bigot. And the woman winces like somebody just told a dirty joke in church.
So, yeah, Clinton gave her speech about the alt-right because she wants independents and Republicans to view Trump's campaign as a vehicle for white nationalism. And there's a lot of truth to that. Trump is the great white hope for the so-called alt-right movement. Many moderates and conservatives, Republicans, are worried that these hate groups will take over the Republican Party. Yesterday, in a CNN interview, Trump said he didn't know anything about the alt-right movement, just as he had once said he didn't know anything about David Duke and white supremacist groups. But this is not an issue that Clinton made up. It's a real concern for many voters.
Quick answers to the next couple of questions. Biggest blunder of the summer for Hillary Clinton, Dan?
Well, she said on Fox News, of all places, that FBI Director James Comey said her answers on her private emails were truthful when he actually said her statement was not true.
Biggest blunder of the summer for Donald Trump, Todd?
I think Trump's attacks on the Khan family, the Gold Star family of a fallen soldier, because that dramatically revealed problems with his temperament and character.
Most important thing the Trump campaign can do to give itself a chance, Dan?
Try to stay on message. Don't ad lib. Don't scream at the camera.
And what does Clinton need to guard most against, Todd?
Overconfidence, plus a possible WikiLeaks revelation as an October surprise.
All right. To both of you, last question. What are the chances Trump makes this a race, a contest with Clinton as we head into the fall, Dan?
Well, the website 538, which called the election exactly 4 years ago, says Trump has a 17% chance of winning. New York Times gives him a 12% chance. Another website that looks at professional gamblers puts him at 20%. I say 20% sounds about right.
And Todd Donkey.
I'd say based on the polls in swing states and the incompetence of the Trump campaign, at least an 85% chance that Clinton will win, and better than 50-50 that she'll win the Electoral College in a landslide.
Todd Domke, thank you very much.
Good to be with you.
Dan Payne, thank you.
You're welcome, Bob.
The 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio are slowly fading to memories. The games you watched may have depended on where you watched the games. NBC's coverage in the U.S. focused on the home team, and the network faced criticism for it. But commentator Bill Littlefield, who was on vacation in Europe during the games, found what seemed to him an exotic alternative.
While you were watching swimmers or the folks playing basketball, the former sleek as porpoises, the latter mostly tall, or runners, jumpers, or the gymnasts hauling in the gold, I found myself abroad in places left a little cold by those pursuits, pursued by our much-celebrated sorts, and where I was, the people followed very different sports. It seemed that every time I passed a glowing TV screen while I was on vacation, there was nothing to be seen but handball. It's a team game, and it's popular in France, and Denmark's excellent as well, and Poland's in the dance, as is their neighbor Germany. Nor is that list complete, but those four were the best among the men, and it was neat to watch them thump each other. It was nothing short of grand, although what they were up to I could not quite understand. They didn't have to dribble, though at times they bounced the ball. They grabbed each other quite a lot, and sometimes they would fall while trying hard to throw the ball into a guarded net where stood a quite unpadded goalie. It's a certain bet that goalies in this sport endure lives likely to be rocky, much worse than soccer goalies or the goalies who play hockey. The women representing France are handball hotshots too, or more precisely runners-up, as they were number two to mighty Mother Russia. The Norwegians and the Dutch were only slightly not as good, and that by not so much. They played the same aggressive game the men had undertaken, and when the clock ran out, they were unbowed, if somewhat shaken. Team handball is a game of skill and stamina. It's hot. But did you see it on TV? I'm guessing you did not, unless you were, like me, away from hearth as well as home. But if, when the Olympics happen, you should chance to roam, you may learn of a game that TV here would never dream of showing you because the U.S. didn't send a team.
Bill Littlefield comments on sports for Morning Edition and hosts Only a Game each Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m.